So it's been a, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but it's been a long time for me. If you think all the way back to last September when we started this, or restarted the class, there were 2 weeks in there where I had COVID. Then we went on a trip. It's just been a lot of stuff going on, and it seems like life just gets busier and busier. But I'm not here to complain about all those things. It just seems like a long time ago that we started this. So I'm kind of needing, frankly, to have a little bit of a break for a while. It is a lot of work to type all these notes and put all this stuff together, especially trying to do it at the level of depth and such that we're trying to cover here. But I think this is important, and I think that some of the work that we're doing here is starting to get some attention from folks outside of the church. It's being discussed a little bit more widely in social media, and people sharing the videos and them being discussed. And I know you guys know where I'm coming from because a lot of you have been here from the beginning. Some of you, well, only two of you really, maybe three of you have been here from the beginning. The rest of you, maybe Bart, can't remember, but I know the Stewarts came in the middle of all this, right? I'd already started this stuff when you guys started attending, I think. Yeah, so, and then obviously you gentlemen, the brothers over here, you guys are new this term, so everyone's kind of coming in at a different spot, but my intention has always been to set forth a defense and a position, a pro-King James position that is accurate and in line with the facts and not saying things that should not be said or those sorts of things. So I'm definitely not a critical text advocate. I'm definitely not a modern version advocate. I'm a traditional text King James Bible believer. And what all these lessons have been put together is from the vantage point of trying to put forward a more accurate understanding of these issues. And I know everyone's kind of coming at these things from a little bit different point of view. So to follow along, if you're joining us online right now and you want to follow along, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, and then if you will scroll down to May 15 right here, you'll see a link for lesson 178. And we're going to go ahead and load that link and get started here. Now, I have, well, how many pages of notes are there here? There's like nine or eight, it's eight pages. Some of this stuff we might skip over because there's a few things that I definitely want to get to before we finish. And I don't want to be rushed at the end and be wishing I had more time to say a few things. So I kind of have in my mind what I want that to look like, and we'll just have to see how the time goes, all right? So you should have in front of you lesson 178, the pre-1611 evidence for the text, final thoughts on the impact of about 1602 on the King James Bible. So since lesson 171, this is now lesson 178 today, since lesson 171, we have been looking at the connection between the document known as Bot 1602 and the authorized version of 1611. All told, we have considered the following on this topic. The work in progress documents, analyzing the pre-1611 evidence for the text, and that's way back now, lesson 162, we covered scholarly awareness of Bot 1602. Then we looked at, in lesson 171, we looked at pre-1611 evidence for the text. We looked at the physical description and contents. And then we spent three lessons, 172, 173, and 174, looking at the Old Testament. And we've spent three lessons, 175, 176, and last week, 177, looking at the New Testament. So all told, we've spent basically 8 hours on this. Now, we could have spent infinitely more time, but I think I've covered enough for you to get the sense and the gist of what's going on without being hopefully too repetitive or too boring in that, okay? So having spent eight lessons investigating various aspects of the connection between Bot 1602 and the King James Bible, I think we can appreciate the veracity of Dr. David Norton's statement in A Textual History of the King James Bible, quote, "There is one complete 1602 Bishop's Bible with annotations by the translators, Bodleian Library Bible in English, 1602 B1. It is the most important evidence for the King James Bible text outside of the first printings because it is the nearest we can get to the translator's master copy." So again, what we've been looking at is probably as close that we're going to get. Certainly other things could be discovered in the libraries of Great Britain, okay, probably is where you would find something like this.
But as far as we know, up to right now, this is probably as close as we're going to get to being able to see the master copy of the work that was handed to the printer, all right? This, of course, means that we have established beyond reasonable historical doubt that the King James Bible, that the King James translators followed Rule 1 and used the bishops as their base text, literally writing their translational choices onto the pages of a 1602 bishop's Bible. So we've seen that for six lessons. I don't need to repeat that. You guys know what that is at this point, all right? So let's get in then to the first point, which is further thoughts on Bod 1602 from Dr. Norton. Now, this is the part that I might cut short, depending on how time goes, because I definitely want to get to the last point in the notes. So part of my thinking was I wanted this material in the printed form of the notes, even if we didn't specifically talk about all of it in class. I wanted it to be there for those who might be interested in reading it. Dr. David Norton believes that Bod 1602 stands out as the greatest evidence we have for the text created by the King James translators. Please consider the following statements to this end. Quote, "This makes it highly probable that the relationship of Bod 1602 to 1611 is paternal or grandpaternal rather than avuncular. For the reading descends directly from a scribe, particularly of Bod 1602. Examples of this sort, show that the annotations in Bod 1602 are highly important as evidence for the text of the King James Bible and have a status that all other evidence lacks." Okay. Now, I think that's an important point, right? Because what he's saying there is this evidence is unique in the sense that it is them conforming the text to the way that they wanted the text to read. And we've seen that now over a number of weeks looking at many different examples. Look at the second quote. "The unique importance of Bod 1602 as evidence for the text is clear. It sounds a warning against over-presumption of error in the first printed text because it sometimes shows that what would otherwise look like an error is the deliberate work of the translators. None of the other evidence does this." Okay? End quote. So, a lot of folks out there on Facebook, social media, YouTube, etc., they assume that, and maybe it's not an unfair assumption, because Dr. Norton is not coming at this from the same vantage point of faith in the text that, say, I have or other King James advocates have. So a lot of people have been quick to criticize some of the statements that Dr. Norton has made. However, as I've thought about him, a lot of what he's saying is where I think he goes wrong is when he starts to speculate as to why something is the way that it is. When you are simply reporting it to be a certain way, that is much more factual because it is what it is. But when you start speculating more than 400 years later as to why something is the way that it is, we don't always know. And we can look at the Greek, we can look at the Hebrew, we can see maybe why they made a choice that they made, but what we're after here is just understanding sort of the facts of the case, okay? So Dr. Norton provides 2 Chronicles 32:5 as an example of this phenomenon. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and call this up on the King James Bible 1611 webpage. So I'm going to go to 2 Chronicles chapter, 32. And you guys should find that in your Bibles. And we will look at, and I want the actual page. Okay, so this particular verse spans two pages. So it starts, verse 5 starts up here, and then it ends down here on the next page. All right, I think everybody should probably be able to see that for the most part. Okay, so, and then in the notes, I have this in parallel columns. So I'm also going to get that set so we can also make reference to that. All right, so let's look at, first of all, the 1602 bishops. So the 1602 bishops has a phrase here at the beginning, and Hezekiah went to lusty, okay, and that is stricken, ultimately stricken in the King James Bible. It's just totally taken out, and it is revised, and he strengthened himself, okay? And so the 1602 bishops and built the wall where it was broken and made the towers and another wall without, and notice, repaired Milo in the city of David and made many darts and shields. Okay, everybody see that? Look at the next, in the 1611, it says, and he also strengthened himself and built all the wall that was broken and raised it up to the towers, so there's some revision there, and another wall without, and notice, prepared Milo. So the difference is repaired Milo versus what?
Prepared
Milo, okay? And then there's a revision here in abundance is added to the end of the verse in the 1611. And then everybody look in your Bible, your standard King James Bible 1769 edition. Notice it is switched back to what?
Repaired
Milo, where the 1611 had what? Prepared Milo. Okay? Now, it would be very easy to say that this is a printer error. That the printer just made a mistake and spelled it prepared instead of what?
Repaired.
Okay? And this is where, in Dr. Norton's opinion, the evidence of Bod 1602 is important. So let's look at the quote now under that diagram. And by the way, you can see that yourself. So let's just go back here. So here's the verse in the 1611. And he strengthened himself and built up all the wall that was broken and raised it up to the towers and other wall without, I think that's what that says, and prepared. So there it is. Is it in the 1611 text as prepared?
Yeah.
Yes. All right. So let's go to the notes. Only the last two phrases appear untouched, yet the translators did revise repaired Milo. They inserted P at the beginning and deleted the I, creating prepared Milo. So, in Bot 1602, are there notations? I don't have a picture of this page because of the limited release, but have they specifically revised this, repaired, to say what?
Prepared
in Bot 1602. Okay? Let's go back to the notes. In the 1616 edition, repaired found its way back into the text and has remained there ever since. The critical point is this. A later edition gives a reading that the translators had explicitly rejected, and this rejected reading has become our received reading. The evidence of Bod 1602 makes it impossible to take prepared as an accident. So an editor must now choose whether to follow the translators or tradition, knowing that the tradition or received reading comes from the understanding of someone in Barker's printing house. So understand, what is he saying? What Norton is saying is that the evidence found in Bot 1602 reveals that they intentionally revised this to say this. That's what the evidence suggests, right? But then in 1616, they switched it to what?
Repaired.
So the repaired doesn't match what the 1602 bishops originally had. All right. So what Norton is getting at is it would be very easy to just look at that and say, well, that's a printer error. And in the absence of some other piece of evidence like Bot 1602, that might be the simple explanation. But when you look at the marginal notes and so forth in Bot 1602, you realize that they intentionally revised repaired to say what? Prepared, and then somebody later put it back to repair. And this is now the received reading. This is what you have in your Bible, right? It says repaired Milo, not what?
Prepared
Milo. All right. Again, an explanation can be hazarded as to the reasons for this change, for its reversal. He gives Hebrew characters, is now usually translated and strengthened Milo. That's what the revised version has. The difference in sense from repaired is that strengthened does not imply previous damage. Prepared similarly omits the suggestion of damage, and this sense of the meaning presumably prompted the translators. They avoided repeating strengthened from earlier in the verse, either because this was a way of marking, that there was that there the Hebrew uses a different word or different form, of the same verb, or simply for variation. In the words used in their preface, not tying themselves to an identity of words, but using another word no less fit as
commodiously.
One might well argue that prepared is indeed less fit, that it is vague, unsatisfactory word to have used here, and then be puzzled as to why it is used at all, since nowhere else is the Hebrew translated as prepared. Certainly somebody involved in the printing of the 1616 edition failed to discern the translator's motive and meaning, so restored the bishop's Bible's word. So in other words, when you're reading this word, repaired Milo, it seems to suggest that the word choice that the translators intended was what?
Prepared,
not what? Repaired. Okay? Now this is where a lot of people are going to lose their minds, because this does not cohere with the standard, narrative and stuff that King James only advocates like to sort of repeat, right? So, but when you look at Bod 1602, the verse is revised right at that spot, and it's revised to the way it read in the 1611, and then somebody in the print shop set it back to where. So we don't know why. They did not leave an explanation. We can't say for sure why they made this choice, and Norton is even admitting this in his first line there of the second paragraph, and he says, again, an explanation can be hazarded. So in other words, even is he guarding himself against that being the definitive explanation of what's going on, because are there other factors here that we just don't know? Okay. Norton provides a second example in 2 Chronicles 6:27. So let me go find that quick. 2 Chronicles 6 verse 27. All right, so we're talking about this verse right here, verse 27. Let's go to the notes. One more typical example, 2 Chronicles 6:27 now reads, "And send rain upon the land which thou hast given unto thy people for an inheritance." Okay? Somebody look that up in your Bible. Is that the way? Somebody read that for me out of your Bible. 2 Chronicles 6:27.
"Then hear thou from heaven, and forgive the sin of thy servants and of thy people Israel, when thou hast taught them the good way wherein they should walk, and send rain upon thy land, which thou hast given unto thy people for an inheritance."
So yours says on thy land, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if you look here it says the land. You see how yours says thy and this says the?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back to the notes. One more typical example, 2 Chronicles 6:27 now reads, "And send rain upon thy land which thou hast given unto thy people for an inheritance." So you notice that thy is there twice, right? Notice the next sentence. This is also how it read in the 1602 Bishop's Bible, with upon thy land translating the Hebrew literally. The King James Bible originally read upon the land, like I just showed you on the screen. And Bod 1602 shows the translators rejecting what has become the received reading. They struck through thy and substituted the. Then trying the text by the Hebrew, one presumes, the editors of the Cambridge edition in 1639 observed the land was not literally accurate, and so corrected it to thy land. Now understand what he's saying there, okay? Did this reading, the land, survive until 1638? So in 1638, when Cambridge is doing the 1638 edition, they're looking at that verse, the land, they're comparing it against the Hebrew, and they say, there must be a what? Printer error here. And so they switch it from the to what? Thy. And so what became the standard reading? The land or thy land? Thy land became the standard reading. The problem with that is, Bot 1602 suggests that they struck thy and wanted to substitute what? The. That the choice, their choice was the. That's what the document suggests. The translator's original reason for the non-literal translation has ceased to be apparent to their successors. So in other words, do they leave any explanation of why they made the choice? So does a later editor come in there now and make what they perceive to be a change back? But Bot 1602 would suggest that the translators made that choice intentionally. So has somebody come out and reversed their choice? Okay? We may guess, so here he is, so notice what Norton says. We may guess as to their original reading, or reasons. The translators may have considered thy redundant in context and justified the decision from the Vulgate, which also admits the possessive, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce the Latin there, but the critical point is that Bot 1602 shows that the translators deliberately rejected the reading that the later editor what? Recreated. Okay? So I know this is like, in, I don't want to sound like Al Gore here, but this is an inconvenient truth, right? This, you can say whatever you want, but when you, so only one of you got that joke, so we'll just move on. But anyway, you can be mad about it if you want to, and I know some who are going to be mad about it because it doesn't fit the narrative, or you can just acknowledge that it is what it is and move on. I mean, the reality is that when you're reading a 1769 King James Bible, are you in some places reading editorial choices that were not necessarily the editorial choices of the translators? It's an inconvenient fact, but it seems like it is a fact nonetheless. Bart?
Was there any evidence in the 1602 that they meant to change it? Or was it possibly or do we know it was a printer error or what?
Well, no. What he's saying is they have crossed out thy in Bot 1602. They have noted in that spot they wanted it to say the, not thy. And then somebody else later on, no doubt probably looking at the Hebrew, and maybe even the bishops, 1602 bishops, could be, decided to switch it from the to what? Back to thy. Okay? Norton goes on to note 24 more similar instances on two tables on pages 41 and 42, along with the following explanation quote. There are at least 24 instances of this sort where later editions have restored a bishop's Bible reading that the translators rejected, and a further 11 that involve the spelling of names. Prepared Milo is the only one where the translator's understanding of the text is lost. All the others are either neutral as far as the reading of the original is concerned, or involve some degree of apparent deviation from the literal translation. I list them here arranged by the date of restoration. In each case, the 1602 and modern King James Bible readings represent the original literally, okay? So if you're looking at this table here, what this is are another 24 examples of the phenomenon that we've looked at here twice, okay? I'm not going to go through all of them. So in this column, you have the scriptural reference. In this column, you have the note that the 1602 Bishop's Bible and modern King James, the one you have on the table in front of you, read the same. The note in this column that the 1611 read differently, and then here's the date that the bishop's reading was restored, okay? So we've looked at 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 25, chapter 32, verse 5, excuse me, and we've seen that the 1602 had repaired Milo, the modern King James has repaired Milo, the 1611 had what? prepared Milo. The change was made in 1616. So if you look at the rest of these, okay? Some of these, I mean, look, 2 years, 2 year. Malachi 4:2. Now let me just say something, okay? Somebody's going to come along and they're going to say, see, the King James is no different than a modern version. The King James has been revised. And in a sense, are they not wrong? But in a greater sense, are they way off the mark? These kinds of things that we see in this list are nowhere near the type of revision that have been made in the critical text and modern versions, where they take whole verses out, or, you know, entire passages are dropped from the text. All right? So I'm not going to go through all 24 of these. You guys have the list. Those of you that are online, you have access to the notes. You can check those out for yourselves. But there's your list of 24 as far as the date of the restoration. Okay? And if you go to page 4, you can see that this was still happening all the way until the text was standardized in 1769 with the one there in Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 17. Okay? So many of them are stuff like this, right? Thy land, the land. We already saw that one, right? And that happened in 1638. So remember, these are in order of the year the change was made. His place, the place. The children of thy people, thy people. The songs of the temple, the songs of the temples. So most of them are not, like Norton said there, most of them are either explainable via a slightly less literal translation, or, let me just read his statement again here, prepared Milo is the only one where the translator's understanding of the text is lost. All the others are either neutral as far as the reading of the original is concerned. So in other words, it could have gone what?
Either way.
Or involve some degree of apparent deviation from literal translation. So in other words, they may have made a choice in that instance to just not translate it quite as what?
Literally.
Okay? That's what he's saying, right? And then we can look at page 4, this point here, regarding the discrepancies of the spelling of names. Nord states the following, quote, he says, there are 11 names given in the 1611 spelling, which are restored to their 1602 spellings by later editions. And you can read what they all are there. So in other words, there's variance in the spelling of these names. The 1611 spelled them one way, and then later on the spelling was restored back to the way they were spelled in the 1602. All right? So you can see there the rest of page 4. 5, there's more, just more examples of similar phenomenon. I don't think we need to read all of that. I would commend you to read the bottom of 4, all of 5, and the top of 6 yourself for more information and more examples. But I want you to go now, in the last half hour, go to page 6. Go to page 6. Now, Dr. Lawrence Vance. Dr. Lawrence Vance is a King James Bible believer who I'm very much in line with as far as his approach. I have cited Vance. I have used Vance extensively. Vance is one of the few of those out there right now advocating for the exclusive use of the King James who has taken any time to study these primary work in progress documents, all right? And I might add that he's probably studied them more thoroughly hands-on than I have, because I believe he has gone to England and actually sat with the documents themselves, okay, to some degree. But Vance is a person's work that King James advocates cannot afford to ignore, all right? So let's look at this point. Dr. Lawrence Vance also addressed the topic of Bod 1602's impact on the King James Bible in his 2015 publication, The Making of the King James Bible New Testament. Let me stop there. When this book came out, I read it and loved it, and told some other people, I'm not going to say who because I don't want to embarrass them,
read it and thought it was exceedingly boring. And why did he write this boring book? Because they missed the point of what the book was doing. Okay? And I would say that if you're looking for an exciting thrill ride, you should not read this book. But if you're looking for the findings of a measured, detailed person doing history, the book is totally, absolutely necessary reading. Regarding the indisputable connection between the 1602 Bishop's Bible and the AV of 1611, Dr. Vance states the following, quote, "There are two ways we know that the 1602 Bishop's Bible was the basis for the authorized, or basis of the authorized version. First, there is the internal evidence, the sheer number of verses in the authorized version that match verbatim the text of the 1602 Bishop's Bible. This will be seen in the collation of the New Testament of the 1602 Bishop's Bible and the 1611 authorized version in the next section of this book." So let me just say that. He went through every verse of the entire New Testament and compared them and noted all the similarities and all the differences and changes between the 1602 Bishop's New Testament and the 1611 King James New Testament. Every verse, every line he went through and noted if there were any revisions, any changes. So you can just imagine how long that took. All right. Second, the external evidence, a 1602 Bishop's Bible used by the King James translators, currently cataloged in the Bodleian Library as Bible in English 1602 B1. The Bodleian Bishop's Bible, as it is called, is a 1602 Bishop's Bible with annotation of the King James translators. I need to check if that should be annotations, plural. Of the King James translators that indicate change made to the Bishop's Bible. It is the only known survivor of the, quote, 40 large church Bibles that were supplied by Robert Barker to the King James translators. Together with the manuscript 98, the Lambeth Palace Library that records the translator's work on the New Testament epistles, it shows the translators at work as they transformed the Bishop's Bible 1602 into the authorized version of 1611. These two things are more fully discussed in the analysis section of this book. So, Vance has done a huge work here in doing this collation, right? Having investigated both the Old and the New Testament portions of Bot 1602 as well as Manuscript 98, prudence dictates that we consider some summative takeaways. To accomplish this task, we will look at the analysis section of Dr. Vance's possessive 2015 work. Prior to the analysis at the back of the book, Dr. Vance provides a complete collation of a 1602 Bishop's Bible with a 1611 AB for the entirety of the New Testament. So like I said, verse by verse, line by line, word by word, compared everything, made a table, noted it, and printed it in the book. Okay? So, here's what he says. The collation of the New Testament of the authorized version of 1611 with the Bishop's Bible text of 1602 yields the following results. So what I'm going to do, guys, is I'm going to put up this table here on the screen. I'm going to try to get it centered so you can see the whole thing. And we're going to make notes on this as we go through this. I'm going to point stuff out to you on this table. I know your copy... I guess that's not...
It's readable.
Is it readable?
Yeah, it's readable. Hopefully it's readable.
Yeah. Okay, so, now listen, of the 7,957 verses in the New Testament, the authorized version reads exactly with the bishops in 2,102 of them. So what does that mean? Verbatim. 26.4%. So a quarter of the Bishop's New Testament and the 1611 King James New Testament does it read exactly identically. Yes. With no revision at all. A quarter of it. 2,102 verses. Alright? Next line. Thus, it read different
and 5,855 of them, or 73.6%. So we should probably write this stuff down here, okay? So how many total verses are there? Somebody tell me the number.
7,957.
That's the total what?
Verses.
Total verses, all right? How many read identical?
26%.
2,102. 26.4% is identic match.
Okay.
That leaves us with what?
855
that are different. 73.6%. So these are identical. These have been what?
Revised.
Okay? So we have total number of verses in the New Testament. So more than a quarter is exactly identical. It would be like taking this page to the Xerox machine in the office, putting it down, hitting copy, and the verse is exactly what? It's the same. Okay? So, of these verses that differ. So now we're going to make an indent here, okay? Of these verses that differ, 2,225, 38% have how many changes?
One simple change.
One simple change.
So,
look, you got 26% that's identical, then you have another 38% that has how many changes?
One.
Okay.
Next line. Have only one simple change. 1,602, or 27.4%, have how many changes?
Two.
919, what percent?
15.7%
have what, three?
Yes.
All right, you can see what's happening to the numbers, right? Then we have 423 verses, what percent?
7.2.
Have how much percent, or how many changes?
Four.
Why don't you guys go ahead and read this to me so I can, what's the next?
191
verses, what percent?
3.3%.
3.3% have how many changes?
Five.
Then what?
85,
1.5% have 6, right?
Yep.
And then we got
1.1%,
7 or more?
1 or more.
It says 1 or more.
That's got to be wrong.
Yeah, it should be 7.
I think it's 7.
Because even if you look over here, it's 7. Because here, see this, 7 plus?
Yeah.
So these columns here are matching those statistics. Okay? So that should be 7. And then we have 336, 5.7% that have, what does he call it? Complex change. That means there's a lot of a revision. All right? So of the ones that are revised, these are the statistics of the ones that are revised. So even of the ones that are revised, the vast majority of them have only one or two simple what?
Changes.
All right? You with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
So, the total, look at the last sentence. The total changes come to 12,812. In those verses with changes, the average number of changes per verse is 2.19. All right? So when I look at this data, what I walk away with is the overwhelming impression that the King James Bible clearly was a revision of what Bible?
the 1602 Bishop's Bible. I mean, it's statistically, it's an impossibility for it to have come from anywhere, from any other source. Okay? You with these? You ever, anybody got any question about these numbers? Because we're going to go over here in a minute here. All right? No? The following explanation accompanies the table. So, to get an approximate percent of the text in each book of the authorized version, New Testament, that basically reads as the bishop, we can take the number of words in each book of the authorized version and subtract the number of changes from the bishop's Bible. Since most changes involve just one word, along with the number of words affected by complex change. The results by book are summarized in the chart that follows. It's above in the notes. The chart indicates for each book of the New Testament the total number of verses. So let's start there, okay? So let's just go to the top line, Matthew. Here are the total number of verses in Matthew. All right? Here are the total number of verses that are unchanged. So of 1,071 verses in Matthew, 402 are what?
Unchanged.
Exactly identical to the 1602 bishops. The percent there is 38%. So 38% of Matthew is completely what?
Unchanged.
Is everybody with that? Then as you work your way across, 302 verses have one change. 187 have two changes. 112 have three changes. 35 have four changes. 9 have 5 changes, 2 have 6 changes, 3 have 7 changes, and 19 of them are what he would call a complex what?
Change.
All right? For a total number of changes, 1,272. Average change per verse, 1.90. Bishops, AV correlation, 1%. 94%. So for the book of Matthew, 94% of the book of Matthew is essentially identical to the bishop's Bible by statistical analysis of the changes. You following that? Okay. We good? Anybody got a question? If you have a question, make sure you ask. The results by book are summarized on the chart, blah, blah, blah. The number of verses that are unchanged, I already showed you that, percentage of verses that are unchanged, the number of verses with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, or more simple changes, the number of verses with complex changes, the total number of changes, the average number of changes per verse, and in those verses, sorry, that exhibit change, and the approximate percentage of text of the authorized version that basically reads as the bishops. All right? So the approximate, now, here's, let's go all the way to the bottom. I hope we can pick this up on the screen. So let's go all the way to the bottom. If you come all the way over here for the entire New Testament, what percent of the bishops' New Testament and the King James are essentially the same? 91%. 91% are essentially identical between a 1602 bishops and a 1611 King James for the New Testament. All right? Now you can understand why he did this for the New Testament. How much longer would this have taken for the Old? Plus, because for the New we have both Bob 1602 and Manuscript 98, can you essentially track it for almost the entire New Testament? Okay? Now you can certainly compare verse with verse, but the added bonus for the New Testament is you can look at the primary documents, work in progress documents to look at more data and more things. Okay, so the approximate percentage of the text of the authorized version of New Testament that basically reads as the bishop's Bible is 91%. There are two things that directly record the King James translators as they transform, the translators at work, excuse me, as they transform the bishop's Bible of 1602 into the authorized version of 1611. a Lambeth Palace Library manuscript, 98, and a Bishop's Bible in the Bodleian Library, Bod 1602. So I think you can see very clearly what the significance is of why we went through all of this information. Because when we go through this information, are we actually seeing them doing the work? And at the end of the day, I'm going to make that a little, bring this up a little higher. You can see that the bishops and King James New Testaments are essentially 91% what? The same. All right? Does anybody have any questions or comments about that? Because if you don't, I did have one more thing I wanted to mention. Mike, did you have something you wanted to...
The thing that's missing is the discussion. The final discussion. If we had a record of the final discussion, then you know, there wouldn't be any speculation as to why it's prepared and not repaired.
Exactly. I agree with that. So I'll reiterate a point I said a few weeks ago. What these documents allow us to do is to see what they did. We don't always know why they did what they did. You see what I'm saying? And Mike is right. That is the piece that is still missing. However, we're cutting it short, but I think when we go to, we're still going to talk about Boyce's notes specifically. There's at least some notation of the back and forth discussion that the men were having as they went through the final review at the general meeting. Okay? But you're right. What these show us is what they did. They do not always tell us why they did what they did. Sometimes you can figure it out by comparing it with the Greek or the Hebrew. Sometimes it's even doing that, as Norton has mentioned, is not abundantly clear. And in the absence of them telling us why, is there going to be a certain amount of speculation that is unavoidable in this conversation, all right? But I would also add, you cannot say what I sort of grew up hearing being said in the pro-King James space, if you will, that, you know, there's really no difference between. Substantively, I don't think any of these things really make too big of a deal. But the fact is that we're reading, when we read our standard 1769 text, we are not necessarily reading only the editorial choices of the translators themselves, because some people have impacted the text after that. Now, I don't perceive many of those, if any, to be necessarily substantive problems, but I don't want to say things that aren't true either. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, I want to say one more thing about this 91% here before we go. So the AB 1611 is a revision of what? The bishops. So is there 91% confluence between them? The bishops was a revision of what? Who remembers? You get a cookie if you can tell me.
Geneva.
No.
No.
Nope.
No cookie.
No cookie.
No cookie for you, Mike. The Great Bible. This was the first Bible authorized by the church. The bishops was a revision of the Great Bible. The Great Bible was a revision of the Matthew's Bible. Remember, the Matthew's Bible was the complete work of William Tyndale. The Matthew's Bible had Tyndale's New Testament, it had Tyndale's Pentateuch, it had Joshua through 2 Chronicles, and it had the book of Jonah in it, right? So Matthew's is a complete work of who? Tyndale. So when people talk about how the King James is 80 to 90% the work of Tyndale, it's because of the line of where it came from.
Matthew's is the, in my mind, Matthew's may be arguably the most important one in all of these, because it's the first one to be licensed by the king, and it's the complete work of who?
Tyndale.
We talked about this way back now. So the Coverdale, the Great Bible, is a revision of the Matthew's Bible. The Bishop's Bible is a revision of the Great Bible. And the King James is a revision of what? The Bishop's Bible. So the reason why there is such a strong Tyndalean line going all the way through there is because of where all these Bibles came from. All right? You following that?
Mm-hmm.
So, I know I did a really terrible job of drawing that there, but you probably, hopefully you understand what I'm saying. All right? So, at that point, over the summer, what I'm going to be doing is attempting to try to read ahead. And you're like, well, what else can you say? Well, we haven't even looked at the 1611 printing yet. We have not talked about its reception, how it was received once it was printed. We got to talk about some of its history and some of those things. And we haven't said anything about when it came to America, what happened with that. So there's a lot of things to talk about. And then I also want to talk about, if we can do it before the rapture, I also want to talk about how all this stuff began to be undermined by those who were coming along with a different theory and a different mindset and a different belief of what we've seen developing here now for the first 100 years of the Bible being translated into English. Because remember, when Tyndale started this, was it illegal? Was he burnt at the stake as a heretic for translating the Bible into English by the king? Now we have a king authorizing a Bible, sanctioning a Bible, setting up the process, giving him with his archbishop, giving rules that would govern the process. All right, so things have changed in that 100-year time span. It took us 2 years to study. All right, so that's kind of where I'm going next. So if you're bored, I mean, you can always bow out, I suppose. But I'm going to keep going, and I think all the stuff needs to be talked about. So, all right, are there any questions? So we'll have class next week. It's not going to be on this topic. It'll be on something else. If you have a topic that you'd like to throw on the table, let me know. In June, the first Sunday in June, Bud Chrysler is going to begin teaching. He's going to do a 6-part study on biblical archaeology for all of June and the first 2 weeks of July. And then I have a calendar that's blank for the rest of July and August that needs some men to step up.